Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. In last month's manhunt for the suspects in the Boston Marathon bombing, many analysts, including some on NPR, termed it unprecedented in recent history. Certainly the search, which effectively shut down much of the Boston area on that Friday, was massive in scale. But writer Dan Schultz says unprecedented is the wrong word. Schultz is the author of the recent book Dead Run, which tells the story of another huge manhunt, this one in 1998, for three criminals who threatened the safety in the Four Corners region of the American Southwest. Dozens of law enforcement agencies and hundreds of officers scoured the desert in search of the wanted men, who were never captured. Schultz, who lives in northern Illinois, joined Mitch Tyke in the studio and explained what set off the manhunt.
What began was just a very brutal murder of a small-town policeman on just outside the town of Cortez, Colorado.
And he had pulled over a water tanker that was reported as stolen.
Right. And that's not an uncommon occurrence in the Southwest. Water tankers are often parked kind of out in the country with keys kind of hidden someplace obvious on them. And so it's a crime of opportunity for kids who want to go joyriding or something like that. So it wasn't a cause for a great deal of alarm. Just as he was radioing back to his dispatch, there was no heightened alarm in his voice or anything that would indicate that he was felt he was in great deal of jeopardy.
So he's gunned down on the side of the road. A water tanker is not exactly a fast getaway car. So it doesn't take long before it develops into a car chase with other law enforcement in the area. What transpired to take this from being a car chase through rural Colorado to a manhunt through the desert?
First of all, one of the factors that really made it the major manhunt that it did was the brutal way in which Dale Claxton was killed. Executed more or less at point-blank range with automatic weapon. Then the truck, even though this is a rather remote area, there were a number of police in that area on that particular day. Not only did you have the Cortez City Police, you had the county sheriff officers, Colorado State Trooper cars normally patrolling in that area, but then they also happened to be having a seminar for law enforcement officers from around the region just a mile up the road. So within minutes, there were literally dozens of police cars responding to this report of an officer down. The truck went through town. The three suspects abandoned the truck, hijacked a flatbed pickup truck. And at this point, police were converging on that pickup truck as they were escaping. And they disabled every police car. They had overwhelming firepower and pretty much blasted their way through town, cruised out 50 miles out to the desert of Utah, and disappeared into the same canyons that had hid Butch Cassidy 100 years earlier.
It's significant that when they went on this spree, they didn't seem to shoot at any civilians. The three people who were alleged to have done this, it's never been proven in a court of law, but warrants were issued for them. They were all associated with anti-government sentiment, which you write is a fairly common phenomenon in that part of the country.
Yes, very similar to what was happening in Boston this week, where the last that anybody had determined, there seemed to be some tenuous connection to terrorism groups, but not a formal connection right at this point is known. Same thing out west in 1998. There were tenuous connections to various militia groups. Whether they were formally part of a group or not, they definitely had a militia New World Order ideology. Made them, in their minds, they almost kind of lived by an outlaw code that police were combatants and civilians were people that they were going to be fighting this guerrilla war on behalf of.
Well, and a lot goes on as this develops into a manhunt, and dozens of law enforcement agencies and hundreds upon hundreds of officers from those agencies go out on the search. But your book makes it clear that the response by all these people, they were kind of ill-equipped to take on a massive search of this remote, rugged place, especially in light of the fact that at least two of the fugitives really knew it very well.
Yes. Within hours, police started flowing into this area to assist with this manhunt. Some of them were asked to come in as cooperative agencies, and many of the others just decided they needed to be there. They took vacation days. They drove up from Florida, came across from California. In the end, in just the manhunt portion of it, not the investigative portion or the administrative support portion, there's estimated over 500 men and women involved in this search. Unfortunately, most of them came from urban police forces, which are generally human-friendly environments. Now, suddenly, they're out in this extreme remote wilderness. This is not a wilderness like, oh, up in the mountains in an alpine meadow. This is harsh desert, canyons, boulder fields, temperatures that during the day hit 120 and then reflect off the rock. These men were not at all trained for this. They had no idea what they were doing. In addition, in these areas, it's just littered with boulders, mines, ledges, ridges, thousands upon thousands of places where suspects can hide, but also where snipers can hide. And so they were at extreme risk psychologically as well as physically in this environment.
One of the images we got from Boston last week was what an amazing job of coordination that played out between agencies. What was the coordination like among these dozens of law enforcement agencies that converged on southwestern Colorado for this particular manhunt?
To the public point of view, it sounded like a very coordinated effort. So I'm assuming that Boston truly was. In the case of the Four Corners manhunt, it was anything but that. Once you're beyond the news conferences in which it seemed to be a coordinated effort, it was just more turmoil and chaos. First of all, the whole thing, as I said, swelled out of proportion to the point that nobody could really manage it. Suddenly you had in the town of Cajon, which was on the second day or third day of the manhunt where they moved the manhunt headquarters to that town, that's a town of 300 people. And now suddenly you have, in addition to those 300 residents, you have to somehow house and feed 500 to 600 officers who have shown up. It was an overwhelming task. The small police forces out there, the small sheriff offices, which normally would have 5 or 6 men total, suddenly are trying to manage 500. People are coming in. Nobody knows who they are exactly. There's some are signing up. Some are, you assign them to an area, to a search area. Those men don't know how to find that area. They're getting lost. You have dehydration going on and having to fly officers that are going down from dehydration out with helicopters. It was total chaos. And then you had the typical bickering and fighting as to who's in charge.
On its surface, it also might seem that a significant difference was that this manhunt was about some men who killed a police officer, whereas the Boston Marathon bombing was treated by many as terrorism. But you're right that there is evidence, never proven, but evidence that there might have been a grander scheme at the heart of these suspects' minds.
There's several mysteries that have never been resolved conclusively with this case, which Dead Run does try to look at. One of them is, why a water tanker? It's not a great vehicle if you're going to commit a robbery. It has a top speed of 65 miles per hour, so it's not a good getaway vehicle. And what were these three outlaws up to? We know that it was probably something significant. One of the outlaws before the incident on McElmo Bridge had bragged to his friends that they were going to be among the most famous outlaws in the country, that everybody would know their names. The police, in trying to determine what this might be, and have basically posited two things. One was they were going to rob a casino near Cortez. I think most police have kind of backed away from that. There wasn't a great deal of money. I think the other possibility that had originally been brought up by police was that they had intended to blow up one of the major dams on the Colorado River. They had looked at both Glen Canyon Dam and Hoover Dam.
And you write that that one of the fugitives was, if not a disciple, certainly a huge fan of the seminal book by Edward Abbey called The Monkey Wrench Gang, in which a group of criminals sets out to do just that.
Exactly. Glen Canyon Dam is, among environmentalists, not a popular structure. It's considered a grave environmental mistake. And in Edward Abbey's book, you know, he has fictional characters who are setting out to correct that mistake by blowing it up. In this case, it appears that Jason McVean was highly influenced by the book. He had, according to friends, it was basically his Bible. Police had found a copy of it in his truck. It was underlined and with margin notes. And he had talked to friends that that would be a goal of his someday to blow up that dam. So in my book, I am guessing that the best reason for a water truck was to turn it into a bomb. Whether it would have been successful or not would have been unknown, but you know, certainly Dale Claxton inadvertently probably stopped something that could have been very tragic.
All three suspects ended up being found dead, one after a few weeks, one after a couple of years, one almost a decade later. Do you think this case back in 1998 changed anything?
As far as the suspects go, that's an ongoing mystery. And I mentioned there were mysteries that were unsolved mysteries yet with this case, even though the case has been closed. All three of those suspects were not just found dead. They were all shot in the head. Now, the police rapidly concluded that each one of them was a suicide. In two of the three cases, the pathological evidence makes it pretty clear that they were not suicides. In the third case, the last person found, Jason McVean, it was 9 years in the desert, and there was not enough evidence to conclude one way or the other whether it was a suicide or not. As far as what changed as a result of this case, I know that Western police departments all across that whole area have now, number one, they've armed themselves better because they were so dramatically outgunned by these three. And then beyond that, they've all have taken courses and set up protocols for these manhunts in extreme conditions. The other thing, and I don't know if they've ever have how they would control it, was the swelling of this manhunt into being quite so large. Some of the people in charge at the end said, you know, we would have done better if we could have kept it small. We could have hired a couple of cowboys and, you know, who knew the area and just formed a small posse the old West way and gone after these guys. And it may have been a case because a lot of their efforts were just trying to hold everybody together here on this.
Well, it is a compelling, fascinating story. And Dan Schultz, thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Dan Schultz is the author of Dead Run, The Murder of a Lawman, and The Greatest Manhunt of the Modern American West. It was published last month by St. Martin's Press. Schultz, who lived for years in Wausau, Wisconsin, now divides his time between Illinois and Colorado. He first spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in April. Coming up next, the joy of driving a convertible is the topic of discussion with our automotive contributor, Mark Savage. Feel the wind in your hair next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.